Shortly after our wedding, Andrew and I sat down and tallied up our collective student loan debt. To me, at least, it was staggering. So we created a plan of attack. We saw a financial counselor, a free one at the library because we just realized how much we owed. We began using budgeting software to keep us accountable to our budget. We purchased a spreadsheet to help us track, prioritize, and pay down our debt. I say we, but I really mean I, because between the two of us, I'm the one who derives perverse satisfaction from micromanaging our finances. Partly it's a hobby, but the deeper truth is that I'm anxious about money. I inherited it, I think, from my family. And ever since I was in middle school, I've always fretted, anguished really, about money, whether I have enough and what we might need. Those spreadsheets and apps and systems are my way of protecting and guarding against an uncertain future. But as our collect reminds us, we are placed among things that are passing away. I wonder if that has ever been more true than it is in this moment. Our bold and courageous youth reminded us just this past Friday as they implored us to deal with the scary realities of climate change. Things cannot continue as they are. One way or another, changes are coming. And it's not just the climate. Our day-to-day lives are full of uncertainty. Things happen that are beyond our control. Medical crises erupt. The economy tanks. We'll be talking in middle school youth group today about things that can happen to a family that make them wind up suddenly homeless. My money anxiety is an attempt to prepare for these kinds of things. But even my preparations depend on things continuing much as they are, when it seems clearer and clearer that they will change. They're like an umbrella in a tornado, woefully inadequate. In this morning's parable, we meet a man who is facing just this kind of unexpected disaster. For our purposes, let's call him Joe. Joe works as a kind of middleman, standing between the rich man he works for and the debtors who owe the rich man money. Joe keeps the books, tracking and collecting the debts. He refers to his boss as his master, which underscores just how much power the rich man has over him, and conversely, how little power he has. And that comes into play when someone tells the rich man that Joe has been squandering his money. We don't know if the accusations are true. We're just told that the rich man promptly summons Joe and fires him. We are placed among things that are passing away. I wonder if Joe thought his position was secure, that it would keep clothes on his back and food on his table, because it's clear that he does not have an emergency fund. Joe considers what to do, and he is, as he says, not strong enough to dig and ashamed to beg. Maybe he's lazy. But then again, if I'm honest, I can't say that I would be excited about those things either. So instead, he decides to start an underground debt forgiveness program, calling in one borrower after another and wildly slashing their debt on the master's books. 100 gallons of oil becomes 50. 100 containers of wheat becomes 80. And he hopes that, after security shows him the door, these debtors will take care of him just as he has taken care of them. We don't know about the character of the rich man, if his lending practices are honorable, or if, as Amos describes, he builds his wealth on the backs of the poor by cheating them. And we don't know the character of the debtors, if they've made bad choices or had bad luck, or if they've just been taken advantage of. What we do know from the story itself, and this is where it gets provocative, is that Joe is the hero. The rich man commends him, and Jesus seems to hold him up as an example. In the interest of full disclosure, I will tell you that some Bible commentaries say that the part of the debt that Joe eliminated was his own commission. Others will tell you that it was the rich man's interest, which would have violated the Jewish law against usury. But the story doesn't say those things. And parables are meant to challenge and provoke and disrupt. And to my mind, those explanations are just a little bit too neat and tidy, a little too convenient. This story would be easier to swallow if we knew that the rich man was bad or that the debtors were good. But we don't, because in the logic of the story, it doesn't actually matter. I think that the manager is the hero of this story because he realizes that he cannot depend on his employer or his job or the economy for security. We are placed among things that are passing away. Instead, he casts his lot with people, specifically with the debtors, those with the least power and the most insecurity. He unburdens them from the weight of what they owe and makes their flourishing a little bit more possible. What's most challenging is how Joe accomplishes those purposes. He engages in some unauthorized wealth redistribution. He does it by forgiving debts that are not his to forgive. Lawfully, the balance of that debt belongs to the rich man. But if we look through a theological lens, there's something more essential than the law. All creation, including everything we possess, belongs to God. We acknowledge this in the prayers. Give us a reverence, we say, for the earth as your own creation, that we may use its resources rightly in the service of others and to your honor and glory. There is only one proper use of resources, the flourishing of all of creation, including all of God's people, each and every one of them. This is why in the law of Moses, every 50 years was designated as a jubilee. Slaves were freed, debts were forgiven. And if anyone had fallen on hard times and lost their ancestral land, in the jubilee year, it was returned. And we see this in the New Testament. In fact, we pray it all the time when we recite the Lord's Prayer. That word translated trespasses can also be translated as debts. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Sometimes our debts are spiritual and relational, and sometimes they are financial. The debts are not Joe's to forgive, but in an ultimate sense, neither are they the rich man's, because everything belongs to God. By our standards, Joe is a criminal. He takes what doesn't belong to him, and he does it in order to save his own skin. He's no Captain America. His motives are mixed at best. He's unsavory, disrespectable, and maybe even a little sleazy, which makes this parable offensive. It's offensive because grace is offensive. It bulldozes our ideas about deserving and undeserving, of earning, of owning, of order. Jesus' passion, the thing he is willing to die for, is the flourishing of all creation, you and me and each and every other living thing, the good, the bad, and the in-between. If our laws and rules and ways of operating are standing in the way of that flourishing, Jesus has no use for them. And wouldn't we feel the same way if someone precious to us was in danger? This parable, like all good parables, leaves us not with answers, but with questions. To what will we hold fast? How much of our life and energy and resources are we devoting to trying to make ourselves secure with things that are passing away? What difference does it make if we remember that all our resources, the things that wind up in our hands, belong to God? How are we called to use them for God's great passion, for flourishing? And what laws and rules and ways of operating are standing in the way? Which ones might we need to disregard in the service of the things that are most important? It is challenging, provocative stuff. God's promise to us is that it is also enduring and life-giving.